You're listening to the Ayn Rand Institute Live podcast series.
21st Century Breakthroughs and Challenges in Infectious Disease by Amish Adalja.
My name is Amish Adalja. I'm an infectious disease doctor, and I work a lot on the intersection of infectious diseases and policy. And there's been a lot of things that have been happening in the last five or so years that really have revolutionized the way we approach infectious disease. And I hope to take you through some of these and give you some kind of digestible ability to understand what you're reading in the newspaper headlines about new cures, new this, new that. And I've got a lot to talk through, but I want to start with just a motivation on why I think this is really important. And I'm addicted to infectious disease. I was looking up, downstairs where we had our lunch for the Intellectuals Network, the things look like viruses. I could see them hanging down. I see them everywhere, infectious diseases. I don't think I see any infectious diseases out in the crowd yet, but why this is important for everybody. These are really interesting, intractable problems that humans have faced basically since civilization began. And I think that gives lots of interesting aspects to how humans have evolved and have kind of faced nature. I think that's one part of it. There's huge benefits to human life. I just came from Alex Epstein's talk about human flourishing. One of the barriers to human flourishing has always been infectious diseases. There's lots and lots of interesting science. And though I'm infectious disease focused, this is broader than infectious disease. And I'll hint at some of the other places where you might see some of these techniques. And some of these techniques were actually pioneered in other parts of medicine. There's lots of ethical issues that are coming up with gene editing and how to think about that. And so for the philosophers in the crowd or people who are interested in philosophy, there's lots of bioethical problems that are coming up with infectious disease. There's intellectual property issues. Can you patent genes? How are you going to do all of this? How are you going to make these things accessible? All of that comes up as well. And I think it's really, really cool stuff that I'm going to talk through. And I have an ambitious agenda. I don't know if I'll get through all of it, but I think this is what I'd like to talk about. The microbiome, universal flu vaccines, bacteriophage therapy, CRISPR, which you've probably all heard of, the HIV cure stories, a little bit about mosquitoes and genetically modified mosquitoes. And if I have time, I'll try to put in some stuff about CAR T cells, which I'll explain as I get there. I have a tendency to talk fast, and I also have a tendency to mix technical terms when I'm talking to lay audiences. So if somebody doesn't understand something, I use some fancy word like bovine spongiform encephalopathy, just start shaking your hands and I'll deconstruct it for you. So the first thing I'm going to talk about is the microbiome. And I wanted to talk about this because it's something that people have been talking about for a long, long time. And I get questions about it a lot. And I thought it would be a good time to explain the microbiome. I gave a talk in Pittsburgh in my hometown, and people asked me a lot of questions about the microbiome in the Q&A. So I thought I would give people a little bit of a primer on the microbiome. Everybody's heard of that concept, right? Yeah, I think most people have at least heard the term. But what it is the collective genomes of the microbes, bacteria, bacteriophages, fungi, protozoa, viruses that live in your body. And it's important to remember that when you're born, if you're born naturally, vaginal birth, you're going to have lots of a certain type of microbiome. But you're going to come out sterile and you're going to be coated with microbiome. Your microbiome is going to start being built up by the birth canal. And you actually end up having, if you look at yourself now, there's 10 times more bacterial cells that make you up than human cells. So there is this push to start thinking about something called the human superorganism, meaning the bacteria, the viruses, all those things that live in your body and live with you, as well as your own genes. And they talk about it as being a second genome. And there's been a lot of work trying to understand this microbiome and see what its role might be in health and in disease and how to manipulate the microbiome for curing diseases, preventing diseases, changing, for example, your body weight, lots of stuff. And just very simple things that the microbiome does. So if I cut my finger and I need to clot my blood, it's going to use something called vitamin K. Vitamin K isn't made by the human body. It's actually made by the bacteria that live in you. So this is not something that people think about, all these germs in you. All of these germs are not necessarily bad germs. There are lots of good germs, and that's what I'm talking about with the microbiome. The immune system develops completely in the realm of the microbiome, looking at it, interacting with it. So it's very, very important for how your immune system develops. Even response, for example, to cancer chemotherapy is influenced by the bacteria that live in your GI tract. There's ways to look at that and say, this person's going to respond very well to chemotherapy, this person is going to respond very badly to chemotherapy. And a lot of the controversies over nutrition may end up eventually being found to be microbiome issues, that it's how your microbiome is altered or changed by certain foods. That may be how you absorb nutrients. That may be what makes you absorb more fats or digest more fats or become skinny or become obese. And they've already noticed a lot of correlations. So there's clear differences, a diseased person versus a healthy person, their microbiome, for example. And it's not just for infections or GI diseases. We even see differences in neurologic diseases. People have been talking about the microbiome of autistic patients being very different than the microbiome of non-autistic patients. There's clear differences between an obese person and a skinny person, clear differences between people who have a Western diet versus those who do not have a Western diet. And one of the things, and where this really intersects with infectious disease, is antibiotic use. So if you think about an antibiotic is killing bacteria, it doesn't discriminate. It's a non-specific molecule that's going to kill a lot of bacteria all over your body, even ones that might not be causing problems. So when you take an antibiotic, it's going to alter your microbiome for months and months and months. So there is a lot of hypotheses about what the overuse of antibiotics will do to the microbiome. And I have a couple slides here that hopefully project. But if you look here in this one, if you look at this normal healthy gut with lots of flourishing types of bacteria, you take an antibiotic and it will kill off a lot of stuff. And what might be left could be a dangerous bacteria. For example, there's one called Clostridium difficile or C. diff. This is how C. diff occurs. It's a bacteria that lives in your colon and it proliferates when an antibiotic kills off all the good bacteria and it's left to overgrow. So this is an interesting hypothesis about how C. diff happens, and it's been proven to do that. And it's also been shown that antibiotics have this perturbation on your microbiome that lasts for some time. And there are correlation studies, and it's important to say that remember that I'm saying correlation, not causation, because we're still in the infancy of the microbiome, that many diseases have this as their ultimate route. And there's a lot of people talking about the fact that overuse of antibiotics, especially in children, how many courses they get as a child, may have long-lasting effects on the microbiome, and that may cause some of childhood obesity. There's even people doing studies looking at links with autism spectrum disorders with the overuse of antibiotics. This is just some other stuff that's kind of coming out with the microbiome, trying to look at mice that have different microbiomes. One has a skinny microbiome and one has a fat microbiome. And you can see the fat mouse and the skinny mouse. But what they do, what mice do, they're naturally what's called coprophagic. They eat their own feces. I don't mean to gross everybody out. That's another thing I do is I don't censor my medical stuff, talk about gross things. But mice will eat each other's feces. And you can give a skinny mouse, fat mouse poop, and vice versa, and you can alter the alteration of the mice's body habitus just based on changing their microbiome. So people are trying to harness this for some obesity treatments, and there have been case reports about this, but this is one of the other areas where you're seeing the microbiome play out. And I think this may be one place where it goes into lifestyle type of treatments for obesity, looking at the microbiome. Another thing to talk about with the microbiome that I wanted to allude to, and I have some book recommendations that are kind of dispersed in here. One is the enteric nervous system. Most people don't remember that the fact that your whole GI tract has a whole nervous system to itself, and they call it the second brain. And 5 times more neurons are in your GI tract than in your spinal cord. And 90% of the body's serotonin is in your GI tract. So there is a lot of interaction between the microbiome, the immune system in your GI tract, and the nervous system. So there's a lot of stuff going on here that really has only been started to really be tapped. And I think that this is going to be a new frontier. And people talk about infectious disease doctors eventually becoming microbiome doctors, but this is going to be bigger than just what's going on in the GI tract because of all of the input that goes in from other body systems there. The one thing before I move from the microbiome I want to talk about, and this is the more gross thing, is a fecal transplant. And you probably have heard about it if you've read any of the newspapers, and I want to explain what this is. This kind of, you should be able to cash this out, what this means after I've told you about the microbiome and the alteration. Some people have a better microbiome than other people, and there are some diseases, specifically C. diff, which I alluded to earlier, where restoring that microbiome by giving someone feces from somebody that has a good microbiome can alleviate the condition, and this is what's been happening. And it's not as crude of a preparation as you might think it could be. Sometimes they can be put into capsules, or sometimes they call them crapsules. But you can take those pills to do that. You can also take it through a tube through your nose or through a colonoscopy. But this is something that has really proliferated for resistant C. diff infections that are hard to treat, and it's not FDA approved. And the FDA has tried to regulate it once, and they actually got such a pushback from the infectious disease doctors that they are now exercising what's called discretionary enforcement. So they're not actually touching this if it goes, if you're doing it for C. diff. If you're doing it for other causes, and there was just recently a death using it for a different disease, they are regulating it. But this is something that's really becoming a major force in trying to treat this infection, and maybe apply to other conditions, including non-infectious conditions like inflammatory bowel disease, Crohn's disease, ulcerative colitis, as well as eventually maybe obesity. So that's the microbiome. And that's a little bit of a primer on it. Now I'm going to switch gears to influenza, which is one of my favorite infectious diseases. And what I want to talk about here is why we have a bad flu vaccine, why it's not the best flu vaccine, and why we're always mismatching it, why we always have to change it. So influenza is probably the greatest infectious disease threat. It's what causes pandemics. It's the only thing that can really cause a global catastrophe from an infectious disease standpoint. It seasonally kills thousands in the U.S. and has a major economic impact as people have to take time off from work in order to deal with it, and all the hospitalizations that occur. What makes flu so interesting is that it's constantly mutating. It has what are called, so these two terms, antigenic drift and antigenic shift. An antigen is just something that stimulates your immune system. And they happen to be the little spikes on the virus. And what happens every season is that they change a little bit. And when they change a little bit, it may take them off of what the vaccine strain was geared towards. So the vaccine might be geared towards one type of strain, and now it drifted a little bit, and now it won't work as well. And this is when you hear about these vaccine mismatches every year. That's what's happening. When there is an antigenic shift, that means it's completely changed. It's shuffled itself up, and it's changed its genes. I have some pictures here how the flu virus can pick up genes from other flu viruses and avian species and basically reshuffle the deck of cards. That shift is what leads to pandemics. But the point is, we don't think about this with any other infectious disease. We have a vaccine, and that usually will take care of that disease for the most part. And with the flu, we have a vaccine that is probably only about 60% effective at best versus preventing flu. That's when it's matched perfectly. And it constantly needs updating. So every year you get a new flu shot because the one from last year probably didn't work because the virus changed a little bit. And the thing is, we make flu vaccines the same way we made them in the 1940s. And this is actually pioneered by Jonas Salk, who's the discoverer of the polio vaccine, the first polio vaccine. And actually today is the 24th anniversary of his death. But we make them in eggs, in chicken eggs. And it takes a long time to make them in chicken eggs. So we pick the viruses that we're going to put into the vaccine in February for the flu season that begins in October or November. So lots of things can happen in between that time because there is a whole other flu season going on in the southern hemisphere, which is opposite to ours, where new viruses might emerge, new mutations might emerge, but these manufacturers are now committed to making this through these eggs. And it's really, this is probably the main reason why we have strain mismatches, because they can't change it on the fly because they're already committed months ahead of time to make it. So we're really doing a bad job at making good flu vaccines. We don't have what we call there's this big push for game-changing flu vaccines, and I think we're far from it. And we make incremental improvements, like we're starting to make vaccines in cells, we're starting to put immune boosters in them, but they're still not the same thing. So the holy grail, and they always say it's 5 years away, but it's been lots of 5 years away, that's why it's so hard to get, is to make a vaccine that will be effective against all flu vaccines, the way, for example, a vaccine against smallpox is effective against all smallpox vaccines. But it's very, very hard to do. But we're getting closer. I think after the last flu season, not this past one, but the one before, it was so severe that there was a big push and a lot of criticism over the fact that we couldn't make a flu vaccine that was universal, and people had really not pushed hard enough for it. So now we've got various candidates, one which is in phase 3 clinical trials, which is very very far advanced, and we're seeing good data from this universal flu vaccine. And the NIH also has a universal flu vaccine, which is really interesting because it uses nanotechnology with the ferritin nanopore particle core, which is effective against group 1 flu viruses. So it's not truly universal, but we're getting there. And it's what's been hard is trying to figure out what doesn't change on the flu. So they're looking at things like the stem of that molecule called hemagglutinin that doesn't change. But this was something that took a long, long time to even think about or even to discover what didn't change. And that's why why people say, I got the flu vaccine, but I still got the flu. It's because our flu vaccines aren't that good, because they're not targeting something that's very core to the vaccine. It's the best thing that we have right now, our current flu vaccines, but I do think we are on the cusp of getting universal flu vaccines, which would really revolutionize the way we think about flu. Because I started this by saying flu is the greatest pandemic threat. It's the greatest pandemic threat because we don't have an effective vaccine that works universally. Once that vaccine is made, flu will no longer have that status. It will be basically taken off of the list. If I was giving this talk in the 1800s, I might be saying smallpox, but then we had an effective smallpox vaccine, and then smallpox was actually eradicated from the planet using that vaccine. So now moving from flu vaccines, I want to talk about bacteriophages. Have people heard of those? Yeah, so some people raised their hand. And I have a picture of Sinclair Lewis's book, Aerosmith, which details, it's a fictional account of the development of bacteriophages. So bacteriophages are viruses that infect bacteria. So we have viruses that infect humans, we have viruses that infect cows, there are viruses that infect bacteria naturally, and they're everywhere. Every glass of water you drink is full of bacteriophages, and they're harmless. They don't do anything to humans. And they're everywhere you look, and you're probably eating one right now. All of you are eating a bacteriophage right now as I'm speaking, most likely. And what the rationale was, you have a bacterial infection, give a bacteriophage to that person, and it will kill that bacteria, and you get better. That's the biological hypothesis with them. And they were tried in the early 1900s, and that's what Aerosmith talks about in that book, the discovery of them and how they're trying to decide when to use them. But what happened was that these came out right around the penicillin era, and when penicillin came out, they were basically supplanted, and nobody really did anything with bacteriophages. They were basically put on the shelf, and nobody thought about them, and they became some kind of historical artifact. Although they were used in certain places, in Poland and in the Republic of Georgia, people were using bacteriophages. But then, in the last 10 to 15 years, we really were faced with the specter of antibiotic resistance, where we have what we call bad bugs, but no drugs to treat them. So people started to think about using bacteriophages again and thinking, could these be actually used in the modern era for all these totally drug-resistant infections? How would we do them? They're so different. They're viruses. How would the regulatory agencies even cope with it? So this became something that people started to think about. And I wrote a piece just talking about this. This is from Leaps Magazine, which I recommend. It's actually edited by Kira Peikoff, but Leaps Magazine, I wrote an article on bacteriophages and how this may be one way out of this antibiotic resistance. And we've seen several prominent cases that have been used. And we've had several prominent cases with highly resistant bacteria. Both involve physicians, and I think that's important because there were physicians that got really bad infections. One person was overseas and got a really horrible drug-resistant infection. His wife is a microbiologist, and she actually tried to get these phages and got all the regulatory agencies to agree, and they gave this man phages intravenously, which has never been done before. A cocktail of bacterial viruses that were specific to his bacterial infection, and he lived. And there was nothing that they could do in terms of antibiotics. He was dying in the ICU in San Diego, and it was a very prominent case because it was the first time that this had been done. People had tried to use phages before on topical types of stuff. So someone has a skin infection, they might put them on there, or somebody has a burn infection, and they may put phages on them. But this was the first time it was given systematically. And then we had a second time this happened where they actually used them topically into a sternal wound infection on a patient with a post-surgical infection. Another physician was the recipient, which is, I think, interesting because physicians historically were people who would try things on themselves. But this happened. And now what we're seeing is that this is starting to proliferate. We're starting to see much more interest in this. We already have a phage center in San Diego now that's doing this. And like I said, you find these phages everywhere. So that's one of the headlines, how a genetically engineered virus is in a rotten eggplant prolonged a teenager's life, where they found the phages from a rotten eggplant because there's bacteria there, so there's going to be viruses that infect bacteria. So this is a very, very, very exciting field that's just starting to reemerge after being kind of gone for a long time because of antibiotic resistance. And one thing that's really great about phages is that they're very specific. They only go after the bacteria that they're designed to go after. So when we talk about an antibiotic, that kills off everything. They're not specific. They're like the prototypical non-specific drug, not like a cancer, like those targeted cancer therapies you hear about. An antibiotic will go after everything. A phage will only go after that which it's that's which is evolved to go after. So there's a special phage for E. coli bacteria. There's a special phage for Staph aureus Staph bacteria, and they're very specific. So it avoids a lot of the problems of antibiotic resistance. And I do think that we'll see this become much more prominent now because of antibiotic resistance. And I think it might be even preferred in certain in certain stages to regular antibiotics. And there is a really great book that I wanted to recommend called The Perfect Predator, which is about that case in San Diego of the physician and his scientist wife's race to get these phages. And there's a lot of interesting information there about how she would not give up and went after the regulatory agencies, everybody, to allow them to basically make a full court press to get these viruses into her husband, who survived. And I think it's a really great story that I recommend. There's some pictures of some phages there, but so that's what a phage is, and that's what a bacteriophage therapy, which I do think will be a way out of this antibiotic resistance crisis, because I think that there's, anytime we use an antibiotic, remember that antibiotics come from other bacteria, come from fungus, they come from other microorganisms. So we're playing in their field. So it's not surprising that bacteria become resistant very quickly, because you're using their tools and they've already seen something similar to it, and they mutate much, much faster than anything else you can even imagine, much faster than we can develop a drug. So anytime you hear about a new antibiotic, it's invariable that you're going to see resistance within a couple of years, and that may go out of it may become out of control, and then these antibiotics can be rendered obsolete. And it's become a major financial and economic burden for a lot of these companies that are invested in it, because they aren't very promising from a market perspective, because it's not like a cancer drug that's going to be used, or a lifestyle drug for high blood pressure or for depression, which can be used for a long, long period of time. These are antibiotics that are going to be used for a specific infection for a short amount of time. And if they become resistant, they're going to have no use at all. So this is a really big crisis, I think, that the field faces in infectious disease. It's just, it's almost an insoluble problem. So I'm now going to move to CRISPR. And most of you heard about CRISPR, and CRISPR have a lot to do with phages. So bacteria are always getting pummeled by phages. And one way thing that they've developed or evolved is this defense system, this bacteriophage defense system, where they find the phage DNA, the DNA of the bacteriophage, and they bind to it and degrade it. But in order to find it, you have to be able to know what its sequence is. And that's the interesting thing that got harnessed, is that this bacterial immune system is very specific for finding specific sequences of DNA, specific genetic codes. And what people thought they could do is take that ability to find specific DNA, almost like a bloodhound finds whatever it's looking for. This system inside bacteria can find DNA, and then it can edit it or change it, and that's where CRISPR comes from. It's a harnessing of a bacterial immune system. Most of you have heard of CRISPR and gene editing. This is where it came from, is looking at bacteria and what they do to go after bacteriophages, which I talked about. So this was a really elegant way to harness something that's already there in bacteria and then use it to improve human life. And I think this is probably one of the biggest breakthroughs that's going to win Nobel Prize after Nobel Prize when it actually comes to complete fruition. It stands for something very complicated: clustered interspersed palindromic repeats. And what that means is, this is a very busy picture, and I'm going to try to explain it. When a phage comes in there, this foreign DNA, it ends up getting captured by the bacteria and stuck inside the bacteria's genes. So then when it sees it again, it can basically make a copy of that will bind to the foreign DNA and then trigger this other protein that will degrade it. Does that make sense at a high level? I'm trying to make it not too simple, but you get the essence of it. So it figures out what you've got, what came in from a phage before, puts it inside its genome, inside its DNA, and then when it comes, and then if it detects it again, a similar one, it sends out a complementary piece, which then binds to it and then marks it for destruction. That's what's happening with that. And what you can do is take that same principle, and instead of looking for phage DNA that's infecting a bacteria, you can look for genetic elements, for example, of sickle cell anemia or of HIV that's inside your body. So in this slide, basically what it does is it allows you to either insert a gene or delete a gene just because it's so specific at finding it, almost like cut and paste, because it has this bloodhound thing called the guide RNA that goes in there, binds to the thing, and then molecular scissors are brought to that and they can cut it. That's basically what CRISPR is doing at a very 10,000-foot level. And there were other ways to do this, but this seems to be the simplest and easiest, and now there are kits that you can buy on the internet to do this at home or wherever you want to do. And you're seeing CRISPR being thought of for gene editing and embryos. We're seeing CRISPR being used to think about curing diseases like sickle cell anemia. And since I was going to talk a little bit about its use for HIV, because I think that's one reason that we saw this gene editing controversy happen was over HIV. So the HIV life cycle is very complicated compared to other viruses. And one of the things that makes HIV very, very difficult to cure is this step here, number four. So not only does the virus come into your cell and copy itself and make new cells and destroy and kill cells, it integrates into some cells. So it becomes part of you or part of your chromosome. And it's stuck in there, long-lived, and you cannot get it. It does not come out. But you can see that there's an opportunity there if you've got something that can cut genes out of things. So there are efforts now to use CRISPR and go after this persistent HIV that's integrated into the genome of the host. And it cannot be reached by antiretroviral drugs. We've got all these great drugs for HIV, but they cannot touch this long-lived reservoir that's in those cells that's integrated. But CRISPR might be able to do that. And the issue is, you know, we've got all these great drugs and people live normal lifespans with HIV, but if you go off the therapy, HIV will rebound because it comes from those cells where it's integrated into the chromosome. So they're trying to reach those integrated pieces of HIV in your individual chromosomes. So this is what one of the big holy grails with HIV. And I want to tell you a little bit now about what happened. Everybody heard about the gene editing thing. I know that Dr. Brook put it on his podcast talking about the gene editing. I'm going to try and explain what happened there with HIV. So this is a picture of a cell here, the purple, and then this is the HIV molecule. The HIV virus. When it binds, it has certain receptors it has to bind to. One of them here is CD4, which most of you probably, if you're into science or all, have heard of the word CD4. That's the main receptor it binds to. But it also has a co-receptor called CCR5. So for a cell to be bound by HIV and for HIV to infect it productively, it has to bind to both the receptor and the co-receptor. But the thing is that 1% of Europeans do not have CCR5. It's deleted out of their chromosome. They have deletion in that CCR5 gene. So they are, in many ways, almost impervious to HIV infection by the main strain of HIV because they don't have the co-receptor. And it occurs in about 1% of Europeans. So what ends up happening is this, a picture of the Chinese scientist. What he did was he deleted the CCR5 gene in embryos to make HIV impervious babies. And because it was something that occurs in 1% of Europeans, he thought it would be something that was good. And the twins were born, and there was a huge ethical uproar because it's really not the best way to prevent HIV. And CCR5 deletion, even though it's present in 1% of Europeans, these people have decreased lifespans. Anybody that has that deletion will end up not living a normal lifespan. And he did this in asymptomatic babies or asymptomatic embryos, which were then born, these girls were not up to consent for it. And it was unclear how much the parents knew what was going on. So that's why this ethical uproar happened, because he changed the germline in these two children that were born. And his rationale was that he wanted to prevent congenital HIV, which it would do, but we don't have mother-to-child transmission of HIV anymore in most countries, because if you're on HIV antiretrovirals, you will not pass that. It's unlikely that you're going to pass that, very, very, very small, pass the virus to a baby during birth or in utero. And you can even, if you're an HIV-infected male and you want to have a child, you can actually do it through IVF now without having any kind of problem. So this was something that really took my field by storm, because it was something that nobody really understood what the full implications were. And the lay press thought, you know, he's making these HIV impervious babies, but most people didn't understand that CCR5 deletions are not benign, and that you are going to permanently alter the lifespan of these children who couldn't consent to that therapy or even knew. And we don't even know what all of the implications are. I think it was a great feat of genetic engineering, but this is one of those things I told you about in my field, that there's a lot of bioethical issues that weren't really thought of at this time. And I think that's something that's coming out. And I think that you're seeing a lot of concern over embryo gene editing and whether or not that will be something that people do. It's one thing to do it to an adult and in the cells that aren't going to be passed on generation to generation, but it's very different when you're doing it to an embryo. So that's kind of unpacking what happened with that gene editing with using CRISPR to prevent HIV in those babies. The other thing, I made CRISPR sound like it's very cut and paste, but it does have off-target hits, and we aren't really clear on where those off-target hits are occurring. So that's also something that's important that needs to be studied, because maybe it's not just going after the gene of interest, but it might be doing some other things and other genes. So it's not quite ready for prime time, although I do think it's going to be one of the greatest tools that medicine ever identifies. I don't think it's quite ready yet to be used clinically until these kinks are all worked out. So that's a little bit on CRISPR, and I'm going to continue on the HIV theme because there's also something really interesting that's been happening with HIV. And I think if you're in the field of infectious disease or medicine, you understand that HIV treatment has really been revolutionized, and HIV is not the death sentence that it was. If I was giving this talk in 1987, it would all be dire and bleak. HIV is something that's really been changed from an acute infectious disease that was always a death sentence to now a chronic illness. And when I diagnose people with HIV, everybody, they're usually very upset, but sometimes I tell them, you know, this is actually doesn't even affect your lifespan if you're on the appropriate medications versus something like diabetes, which automatically takes time off your lifespan because HIV medicines have gotten so great. We can't cure it, but it is something that has become really easy to treat now, one pill once a day for most people. You've got 37 million people in the United States living with HIV. 37 million people in the world living with HIV, 1.1 million in the US. We still have 40,000 new infections that are occurring every year, and 15% don't know their status, and they are the ones that are the most contagious because they don't know they're infected, so they don't change their behavior, they're not on medications, so they are very infectious. And we've had every year. Yes. And 35 million total deaths have occurred worldwide from HIV. But I just want to put this slide up to show you what's happened with HIV. This line is when we develop the new drugs. And you basically see the number of AIDS cases and HIV deaths going down to a very, very low level. The lowest that we've seen is kind of plateaued now. And that's what I'm talking about when I talk about HIV as a chronic disease with normal lifespan, now from multiple pills a day to one pill once a day, which is better than most like high blood pressure pills. So there has been this great advance in HIV, but we still have 40,000 new infections, and it's still something that we don't have a cure for. So there's a couple of things that you might have seen in the press or heard about. There's a plan to eradicate HIV, and I'm going to try and explain where that comes from. So this acronym, U equals U, undetectable viral load means untransmittable. So if you are on the virus, and it's not grammatically correct, but that's meant to be not grammatically correct. If you're on anti-HIV medications and you cannot find the virus in your blood because you're suppressed, you cannot transmit it to anybody else. So this whole concept of U equals U, it really changed the way that people with HIV were dealt with because they are not infectious. If their viral load is not measurable because they're on the medication, they're taking it, and they're responding to it, they cannot give it to anybody else. So then you can't find any forward transmission. And then at the same time, we had the development of something called PrEP, or pre-exposure prophylaxis, which you might have heard about. It's in the news a lot. There's all these patent issues over it. What PrEP is taking a daily pill in high-risk individuals to prevent infection. So you take this pill every day and you cannot get HIV as long as you're taking that pill. So this is being scaled up a lot in the United States, although there's still some stigma about doing it. But these two things, these two concepts are what are the cornerstone of like the whole HIV public health policy to try and get infections down to zero and how it might be defeated is using this undetectable viral load with people that are on treatment and then putting people that are at high risk on PrEP. And this is what's being scaled up and studied, and these are two of the biggest things that I think that have happened in HIV. Now, there are two real cures of HIV, and I'm going to just go through them a little bit to talk about what happened there. And this is a little bit complicated, but there was one guy named Timothy Ray Brown who actually named his name. They called him the Berlin patient. Then there's a London patient, and then there's a rumor of a Dusseldorf patient. And these are interesting things that they're interesting case reports, but they are not representative of how we will cure HIV. These three people had HIV and they happened to have cancer, a leukemia, lymphoma type of cancer, needing a bone marrow transplant. Now remember what I told you about CCR5, 1% of the population has the deletion. These very clever doctors that took care of those patients got bone marrow donors that were CCR5 mutants and gave them that bone marrow. And that's how they eradicated the virus in these three patients, by giving them bone marrow from somebody who was impervious to HIV. It was a very, very elegant thing, and they looked and looked, and they couldn't find the HIV. So these are the three case patients that really show at least proof of concept that you can do this. It's not something that you would want to do, because obviously when you get a bone marrow transplant, it's not a benign process. Some of these patients got total body irradiation, chemotherapy. They have to, that's a lot of burden, especially when we have a drug that can control HIV. So this isn't what you would do for everybody, but in patients that had cancer that needed a bone marrow transplant, I think it was an elegant way to exploit the biology of HIV and cure them. And I think that it really was interesting. But so now we say that there's a cure of N equals two. The Dusseldorf patient hasn't officially been called a cure, but there's two so far that are there. And I think that this is really exciting and really fancy stuff. And it just shows what they took from this theoretical knowledge about HIV and then applied it into real patients. And I think it was everybody was really cheering for it. But it isn't something that you can go to the clinic and get unless you really need a bone marrow transplant for another reason. So that's my little bit on HIV. Now, the next cool thing I want to tell you about are mosquitoes. And they are the scourge of mankind. And they are, if human life is your standard of value, mosquitoes don't factor into that. They are transmitters of all kinds of badness: malaria, dengue, Zika, yellow fever, chikungunya, West Nile. There are so many infectious diseases that are transmitted by mosquito. It's said that 50% of humans that have lived died of malaria. So that's 50% of humans that have ever lived have died of malaria. So this is, they talk about malaria as being the immune system of Africa. And I've got a mosquito here. This is crazy. So the thing about mosquitoes is that they're very hard to control, because there's not one size fits all type of stuff, and they live in your backyard. So for example, the mosquitoes that spread Zika and dengue and chikungunya, they're adapted to live around humans. So whatever you have in your backyard, an old tire, even a bottle cap from a soda bottle, whatever junk is in your backyard or debris in an urban area, those mosquitoes exploit. And it's very, very difficult to get people to clean up their backyard or to clean up the street or to clean up whatever these mosquitoes are using for standing water. So you have to have very effective community engagement when you're doing this. And when they've had dengue outbreaks, for example, in Key West, they had the children do it they told the children to do it at school because the children would go home and make their parents do all of this stuff. And they made all these cartoon contests to draw mosquitoes just to get the kids involved. But that's really difficult to do. And it only works so well as your community is engaged to actually get rid of these mosquitoes. And there's some people that aren't even there. There's abandoned properties. It becomes very hard. And with pesticides, there's a lot of resistance to the mosquitoes themselves have become resistant to a lot of types of pesticides, so they don't always work. So one elegant solution is to try and modify these mosquitoes so that they're unable to transmit these infections. So there is something called, these modified mosquitoes, I'm going to talk about a couple different types of them. So it's important to remember mosquitoes, it's only the females that bite, not the males. The males have they drink the fruit nectar and flowers and things like that. It's the females that bite and take the blood meal. So there's one company called Oxitec that made something called the friendly mosquito. And this is interesting because they had to label it this way because of its genetically modified origin. And they don't want to, people are very nervous about Jurassic Park scenarios happening with these mosquitoes. But females only bite. Only females bite. So what this does is they modify males. Males mate with the females, and the offspring is not viable. And that's what they do. They release these mosquitoes into areas, and it decreases the population of mosquitoes. They've been released in places, for example, in the Cayman Islands, in Brazil, where you can see diminishing numbers of those mosquitoes. At the think tank I work at, I got very interested in this, and I wanted to understand what was going on. And it was really interesting because they were going to release these in Key West in a neighborhood, so I wanted to do a survey and see what was going on there. So I found all the addresses in this neighborhood, and I sent this survey instrument to these people, and I published this paper. And it was crazy how much the anti-GMO movement had really moved into that and had changed the whole perspective of these people against these genetically modified mosquitoes that were sterile males that could never do anything. And it was only in a restricted area, and you could always repopulate it with the nasty ones if you wanted to. And they were very against it. But one thing I found is if you knew somebody that had a mosquito-borne illness, you were much more likely to be supportive of genetically modified mosquitoes. But it was very strange. People thought I was, they didn't know, just even being involved, people were very nervous there about being taken over by this company. People have read too many books about these fictional things, and it was very, very interesting to see how the anti-GMO movement had happened. And it was interesting because it was the United States that had this issue, but when they were in other countries like Brazil or the Cayman Islands who deal with these mosquito illnesses, they had no problem because those people actually live with that infectious disease and really saw the benefit of these genetically modified mosquitoes. There's other ways to do this as well. There's something called mosquito mate, which is not technically genetically modified. There is a bacteria that you can put inside mosquitoes that makes them sterile. So you're seeing this, it actually was released in Fresno, California. These are things, they're called mosquito mate, but they're not GMO because it's a bacterial infection. So they don't have to go through the GMO regulation issues, even though the FDA has been on the side of all of these and have pushed for them completely. It's the actual general population that has been against it. The USDA and FDA have both signed off on these types of things. So these are really interesting ways to combat some of the things that have been around for a long, long time. One other way to do this is something called a gene drive, and this is a little bit more complicated. This is a genetically engineering technology where a gene will propagate through a population by changing the probability that it gets inherited. So when you have a gene, you have a 50% chance of passing it on to your offspring. A gene drive increases that. So over time, it will change the whole population. And that's what people are a little bit more nervous about, that because it's permanently altering a population. And like if you see here, there are pictures where the gene is kind of moving through here. And when you have a gene drive, it almost all of them have it. So there are efforts to put gene drives in the malaria mosquitoes so that it renders mosquitoes unable to transmit malaria. And like I said, this is a disease that's killed 50% of all humans. It still kills close to 1 million people a year. And we don't have really good measures against malaria. So this is one of the ways that we're going to see malaria probably be fought. And it's interesting that, you know, we talk about Bill Gates and the technology with Microsoft. The way Bill Gates approaches infectious diseases is very much like the way he approaches Microsoft, at least from what I know. The Gates Foundation does push forward some of the best technologies for infectious diseases, and he's put himself behind gene drives and has really been pushing to eradicate these malaria mosquitoes, and has taken some heat from some of the environmental groups who are against him, but he's stood strong against them, pushing for gene drives to be used against malaria. So that's one other important thing technology that we're going to have against malaria. When I talked about these other types of mosquitoes, so it's important to remember that they're all monolithic. These work against mosquitoes that transmit dengue, chikungunya, yellow fever, Zika, not the malaria mosquitoes, which are completely different. So there's lots of different species of mosquitoes, and you might not have a one-size-fits-all type of solution to them all, but that's what gene drives are being targeted at, the malaria mosquitoes. So I do have time for CAR-T, we can take questions for the rest of the time. So CAR-T therapy is something that's really, really fancy and really cool. And it's really been changing the way people deal with cancer. I don't know if anybody's heard the term CAR-T. Maybe if you're an investor in pharmaceuticals, you might have heard it. But it stands for chimeric antigen receptor T cells. So that's a fancy word. T cells are part of your immune system. You have two main cells and one part of your immune system, T cells and B cells. So T cells are really important to kind of orchestrate what goes on in the immune system, as well as killing infected things. And it's not just that they're killing bacteria, they can kill cancerous cells. And what CAR-T therapy does is it basically, you take a person that has a cancer, a specific cancer, you pull their T cells out, you rearrange the receptor on the T cell and target it specifically to whatever you want it to target. And right now they're being used for leukemia, lymphoma. That's what their FDA-approved indications are. And then you put it back into them, and then those T-cells go off with their new mission and attack whatever they're attacking. And this is what you're seeing. There's companies like Gilead and Kite that have these CAR T-cells that are approved now for cancer. And it's really changed the way what were death sentences. And it's going to be used, I think, primarily in cancer. But one of the other places that you may see it be used is for HIV, for that same thing I told you, that there are these long-lived infected cells that nobody can get to. So they are trying to take CAR T cells and have them move towards those cells that are infected with HIV in order to attack them. So I think this is another exciting thing that's going to be different. It's not going to just be infectious disease. It's primarily an oncology type of thing. It might end up being an autoimmune type of treatment, but it's really fancy stuff that really wouldn't have been thought of several years ago. People who would have died from leukemia are now living because of this type of issue. They do get sick when you put those cells back in, because it creates a huge storm in their body when that war happens, but it is something that you're seeing. The fancy side, you're just talking about how you do it with HIV, but that's too complicated to explain on here. But it would work against, they're trying to do it on HIV. So I think I have a a lot of time for questions now. So I'm happy to take questions on any of these topics. And I think we have 15 minutes left for questions. So I hope that was interesting to you. It was a whirlwind tour of things that I think are really cool. Hopefully you thought they were cool. Thank you. And just to recommend, Leaps Magazine is really good. If you want to keep up, people always ask me, how do I keep up on science? They ask me, I think Leaps is a really good magazine, and I told her that I would plug it a little bit there too. And that's my blog site and my Twitter handle.
A lot of the situations where we use antibiotics, we don't know exact or even very, even roughly, which strain or which type of bacteria we're dealing with. So we do also need something that's, even though it has obviously side effects, we do have situations where we don't we can't use a specific treatment because we don't actually know for certain what we're dealing with.
Sure. So he's asking about when you use a very specific therapy, how you would do that when you don't know what's causing it. And that is a big problem. And it's probably a problem that really doesn't need to be a problem anymore. We do have new, what we call companion diagnostics that are getting quicker and quicker at figuring out exactly what's causing an infection. And so you can get that time down from days down to hours now. It's just taking a while to get uptick. And it's all FDA approved and out there. It's just not being used in hospitals currently because it's expensive and cost prohibitive, but they're still working that out. So we are going to get better at figuring out what you have. Almost, I call it a tricorder culture, like in Star Trek where the guy just scans. We have that technology. It's just taking a long time to actually make it into hospitals and individual clinics. But what you would think about, so if you have to treat somebody for an infection, even if you start an antibiotic for a couple of days and then you get the culture result back and you realize it's this, then you can do that and shorten the therapy or target it at the end. So it's not an all or nothing proposition, but we do need to get better at diagnosing infectious disease and faster. It's one of the things that I work most of my time thinking about is how to get better at diagnosing infectious diseases. And it's strange because in cancer, now we sequence a tumor, you know exactly what it is, and you do that. But with infectious diseases, we often don't do that. And people don't want to do that because they think most people get better from them, or they're so used to giving antibiotics, it's so easy to do that. But that's what's gotten us into this antibiotic resistance problem because we've been so nonspecific with infectious diseases. So I do think that bacteriophages will, for them to proliferate, we have to get much better at specific infections.
In one of your slides, it seemed like you were saying that you could use bacteriophages to modify the genes of existing people. Is that... I didn't understand that slide.
Okay, I'll
Would
go
you
back.
Be able to explain that?
Yeah, sure.
It's so, quickly.
Yeah, so I wasn't... So I was trying to introduce where CRISPR comes from, and I probably did a bad job if that's there. So what I was doing in this slide was bacteriophages infect bacteria. Bacteria have a defense system against bacteriophages called CRISPR. So those are my segue from bacteriophages to CRISPR, because how people found CRISPR was trying to figure out how bacteria fight phages, and they use CRISPR. Then people realized that CRISPR is so exquisitely good at finding specific sequences of genetic material. Why can't we turn this phage tool that bacteria use to go against phages as a genetic tool for humans? So phages don't change your bacteria. It's just that this is what the bacteria does when it sees a phage, and that's how the whole CRISPR system works.
Hi, thanks, that was really fascinating. For most of my adult life, I've been dealing with the effects of a long-term Lyme disease infection. And I've heard ticks referred to as nature's dirty needles because, like mosquitoes, they can carry and transmit a lot of other nasty pathogens. And so I was curious if you are aware of any recent efforts to apply things like the gene drive techniques that you talked about to other disease vectors like ticks as well as mosquitoes?
I do think there is an effort. I think that Lyme disease has become a major issue in the United States as the range of that tick expands as more people are diagnosed. So I do think that there is an effort underway to modify the ability of these Lyme ticks to do it and other vectors. It's really applicable to all of them. It might be a little more complex. We actually had a vaccine for Lyme disease, which was an interesting vaccine because you took the vaccine as a human, and what ended up happening was a tick would suck on your blood and the vaccine would go after Lyme inside the tick. But it eventually got pulled off the market because there was bad sales, and then there was a lawsuit, which ended up being kind of a bogus lawsuit, but the company didn't want to deal with it anymore. But that was one way that they were trying to modify it, was actually vaccinating the ticks by vaccinating humans against it. Wow. But there are efforts to do that.
Thank you.
Fascinating talk. I'm particularly struck by the figure you quoted, that 50% of humanity, of all of humanity, has died as a result of mosquitoes. And that raises the question of the politics of the matter. I'm thinking of the wave of misanthropic eco-activism and alarmism that followed the publication of Rachel Carson's Silent Spring, and how DDT had virtually eradicated malaria 40 years ago, and then with the banning of DDT, suddenly we've got a million people a year dying of malaria. What do you think of the politics of this, and how are the politics playing out with these sorts of technologies?
Right, so I think that you hit on a lot of stuff that goes on with malaria. So Rachel Carson published Silent Spring, which caused the U.S. to stop funding DDT. And Rachel Carson is from Pittsburgh, and we have a Rachel Carson bridge in Pittsburgh that I have to drive across a lot. I always say that there's no Rachel Carson bridges in Africa. So what ended up happening with DDT, so DDT was tremendously successful in certain countries. It had decreased the malaria down to almost nothing, like, for example, in Sri Lanka. There were places where there was DDT resistance happening, and DDT isn't the answer now because there is so much resistance in the insects, not among the population. So there is a lot of politics there. So when we talked about doing genetically modified mosquitoes, there was a lot of pushback. There are lots of pushbacks because you're tinkering with Mother Nature, that it's going to be a Jurassic Park scenario. You're going to have some mutant DNA. So that is very hard to do. But I've been successful, at least when I talk to the press about this, that, you know, that human life has to be the standard. And it seems to resonate. And I think that when the Zika epidemic occurred in a couple of years ago, I think it really got people understanding what some of these infectious disease risks are, because you had people being born with congenital abnormalities that we're never going to recover from. And I think that changed people's view on mosquitoes, which is what always happens. It's this availability bias. When they see it in front of them, then they get very nervous. And I think that's changed a little bit. And I do think, at least in the infectious disease community, that Rachel Carson's work with DDT and her push against it is not really recognized as anything good.
Can overuse of antibiotics cause an autoimmune disease, a high ANA?
There are definitely overuse of antibiotics can cause lots of different symptoms, and there are antibiotics that can trigger lupus, for example, which is an autoimmune disease, which might not necessarily be from overuse. It could even be from a single use that can trigger an autoimmune reaction. We do know that autoimmune diseases have a lot to do with the microbiome and a lot to do with the immune system. So there are correlations with use of antibiotics in the development of autoimmune diseases. It hasn't been proved to causation level yet, but there's definitely correlations there, but not enough to say that this is definitive. Okay. There are people actively investigating that.
Thank you. Thank you for your talk. So in a recent conversation I had, some people mentioned that they referred to diseases of affluence, and specifically they were talking about, you know, the Western diet and the kind of diseases that may come from that, and particularly things like that, and perhaps things that come from the overprescription of antibiotics. People have a general idea and perspective that modern medicine is somehow making us worse. And so, what is your response to that perspective and thoughts?
I wouldn't put it on. I definitely think that the overuse of antibiotics is making us worse. I don't think that that's a good thing by any measure, that we have lots of cascading effects from the overuse of antibiotics. When people talk about diseases of affluence, they also, I think, talk about things like, for example, that you get Legionnaire's disease because we have air conditioners now and there's cooling towers there. So there are things that with industrial society that have changed the mix of infectious diseases that we get. We get less cholera, for example, but more in the United States, but more Legionella in the United States, less malaria in the United States. So I don't think that modern medicine is necessarily making us sick. I think that there's just different risks based on your lifestyle. With infectious disease, it's all about the interaction between you, the environment you're in, the people you're around, the animals you're around. So that's always going to change, and you're going to have different mixes of infectious diseases as you move to different socioeconomic contexts. But I don't think that modern medicine is making us sick, although I do think that there are a lot of people who are prescribed things that they probably shouldn't be. There's a lot of overuse of things like antibiotics, probably lots of overuse of other medications that are not needed to be done. And I think there's less of the of diet, exercise, all of that from many of these lifestyle diseases. But I wouldn't pin it on modern medicine. I would think that there's probably bad practitioners of medicine that use pills instead of when they could be doing other things to do this, and using too many pills that are interacting with each other and making you sick. But I wouldn't put it all on modern medicine.
And by correct in thinking that we can impact our microbiome through diet, and if so, where can we find out more about that? I was hoping for things other than sauerkraut and kimchi.
Yeah, I do think we can impact our microbiome through diet. I think there's lots of studies trying to figure out how long lasting it is and how well it works. And there's this whole probiotic industry, which I don't recommend people buy probiotics. They're probably a little bit of a waste of money. You don't really know what's in those things because you don't know what you're getting. There are people who push fermented foods like sauerkraut and kimchi and kefir, which is that yogurt drink. I don't know how well that actually alters your microbiome, but it's cheaper and tastes better than probiotics, most likely. There are efforts to try and do this with diet. We know that changing your diet from Western diet to a diet in, you know, a tribal diet, for example, they've done those studies where it's very different and you can switch it around based on that diet, but it's unclear how easy it is to do that and how long it lasts when you do it. But that's also one of the holy grail type of things to try and change is the diet with the microbiome with the diet. And I think eventually when they figure out the obesity formula, the right thing, that's probably going to set off a whole new industry. Like, so for example, they did studies where they look at people who live in, I'm just using that as a general, people like remote tribes in Africa or South America. If you look at their microbiomes, they're very different than a Western diet, a person on a Western diet in the United States. But if you feed each other the others, you can switch them. Just like I picture the mouse, the skinny mouse and the fat mouse, you can switch the microbiome like that. But it's unclear how long lasting it is or how the best way to do it. But they do have differences, and you can mimic each other by switching the diet to what the other person had. But it's not completely worked out. And I think it's still, like I said, this is in the infancy of trying to pull all of this together and figure it out.
The bottom line to my question is going to be, what do you think is going on here? Politics, hospitals refusing to admit there's a problem, or what? And the subject area is C. diff. About 2 years ago, I started a letter campaign with the epidemiology department of a major hospital in the LA area, because the info sheet they were sending people home with just said, use antiseptic. And everything I had read, and that my close friend who was a lab tech for 20 years had read, says C. diff laughs at antiseptics. It requires bleach to get rid of C. diff. And we wrote to the epidemiology head, and he sent back a letter that said, our info sheets follow the NIH guidelines, so we're not going to change anything.
So she's asking a question about C. diff, which I alluded to earlier. This is a bacteria that lives in your colon that overgrows when you take antibiotics or you get infected with it. It can cause severe diarrhea, abdominal infections. It can be deadly. It's a scourge of hospitals and nursing homes. And what's interesting about C. diff is it's not just a bacteria. It also forms spores. And those spores are very hard to get rid of. Anything that causes spores are an evolutionary mechanism to actually resist desiccation and being able to be cleaned up. So it's very difficult to clean those up. And you do use bleach. And most hospitals will do terminal cleaning with bleach, and then they actually UV light zap the room with UV light in order to kill C. diff. It's very hard to come up with good protocols to use in home, and I think that's the issue that you have. And there's nothing prohibiting you from using what the hospital uses. I think that each hospital uses its own sheet, and they don't want to.
No, the hospital sheet just says antiseptic. It doesn't say Clorox with bleach.
Yeah,
it doesn't specify bleach.
Sometimes I think it's because the risk management departments of those hospitals don't want to be too over-prescriptive and then be held that way. So an antiseptic bleach kind of falls under the antiseptic rubric. It's just that they're not prescribing it in the exact detail that you would for someone doing a hospital in a hospital room. But it's
basically what they're recommending people do at home is ineffective.
Yeah, it is, unless you do it properly. Yeah.
Quick question on shingles. We were told not to get the shingles vaccine because they thought, our pharmacist said that several of the people that took the vaccine, got the shot, ended up having very bad flu symptoms this year. And then, of course, it was a nationwide shortage. So I just wondered if you had an update on that and whether it's safe to use now.
Okay, so the shingles vaccine, there's two versions. There was a new version that came out a couple of years ago called Shingrix, and it's very effective at preventing shingles and preventing the complications of shingles, which one of them is this nerve called something called postherpetic neuralgia, which is very, very debilitating. And this vaccine was a big step up and better than the original one. So there was a huge rush on it, and it became short. It had shortages. It does cause side effects in about 30% of people, flu-like symptoms, sometimes a rash, aches and pains. They're minor and they're transient. They don't get classified as very serious reactions. I tend to tell people to protect yourself against shingles, it's probably worth it to get that, but it's a risk-benefit thing that you have to think about whether you want to do, and shingles is a debilitating disease you don't want to have. And I do think this new vaccine is better, but it is a little bit more reactogenic, so you have to bear that in mind, and it's two doses. But I do think that people should get that vaccine if they're at risk for shingles based on their age. I think time is over. Thank you again. I hope that was useful.
Thanks for listening to the Ayn Rand Institute Live podcast. Subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listen. You can also find us on YouTube. If you like this content, please share or leave us a review. For more information, go to AynRand.org.